This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what's the whole network galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands for the super athletic stuff, like running gear for cruising up the trail. Woo! And the super athlete-ish stuff, like fishing gear for chilling by the creek. Nice cast. Fitness apparel to push for higher reps. You got this. And golf balls priced so you can afford to lose one. Or a few. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athlete-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's Fielder?
He's gone to the dog.
My guest today is a gentleman I've wanted to have a conversation with ever since we became friends on social media a few years ago. When I started this podcast, I knew right away that he was one of the people that I wanted to get on the show. And when he consented to come on the podcast, I remember thinking, this may be our most, or certainly one of our most interesting guests in the history of the show. And there were several things that drew me to this gentleman. And the first thing was his photos that he posted on Facebook with his dogs and his coon hunts. And I kind of liked the way he took a no-nonsense approach to talking about his hunts. There wasn't any bragging. There wasn't any blowing. Just pictures of his dogs and pictures of the game they caught. And then there was one thing that I particularly noticed was his beard. You know, the Robertson boys there with Duck Dynasty made these long beards famous. Well, our guest today certainly would qualify for that and has an awesome beard. And then when I found out that he had the career he had and looked at some of the pictures that he posted when he was working, I thought, man, that's quite a transition. Our guest today and I have a mutual friend and a guy named Bill Schenninger up in Ohio. And I had told Bill that I was going to contact our guest, and he told me that he thoroughly enjoyed a visit that he had with him and warned me that I probably couldn't get everything in the complete story in the episode. You know, I don't know a lot about our guest, but I'm getting ready to learn, just like the rest of you. I want to welcome to the Gone to the Dogs podcast, Mr. Al Medcalf. Al, how in the world are you?
I'm doing fine, Mr. Steve, and it's an honor that you asked me to do this.
Well, I tell you what, I'm the one that's honored, Al. You know, in a few brief conversations that we've had now leading up to the recording of this podcast, I knew that I picked well when I gave you a call and asked you to come on. You live in Georgia, right?
Yes, sir. I live in Barnesville, Georgia. It's west central Georgia. We're about 30 miles north of Macon, 60 miles south of Atlanta, and there's, I think, three counties between me and the Alabama line.
I got you. So you're over there in some pretty good coon hunting, I guess.
It's pretty good, especially when deer season goes out.
We have to battle those deer hunters more than we'd like to, don't we, it seems like, anymore. Yeah. Well, okay, so that's where you live now. Now, is that where you were born, raised in that part of the country?
Yes, sir. I was born, we used to have a clinic in Barnesville, and it's no longer there. It wasn't a hospital. They just called it a clinic, and that's where I was born, probably, I'd say, 3 miles from where I live.
I see. Well, I've always kind of envied people that got to stay in the area where they lived. Of course, I was raised on the edge of a town when I was growing up, as somewhere probably around 18,000 to 20,000 people. But we lived right on the edge of town, and I could walk across the highway and be in the squirrel hunting woods, you know, when I was a kid. But now that area's grown up a lot. All the areas that I used to hunt, I wouldn't be able to do that at all now. But, just for another point of reference, Al, how old are you now?
I'm 66.
66. And you've been retired for how long?
Since November the 1st, 2012, so 9 years.
So tell our listeners what you did for what, 30-some years?
In 32 years, I was a Georgia State Trooper. I worked the road for the majority of the time, and then I transferred into safety education and, you know, went to businesses and schools doing safety talks and stuff like that. The last job I had was implied consent, and every quarter you have to check the calibration on the intoxilizer machines that you get the DUI suspects to blow in. And I traveled around checking those, and that was really a real good job. It was Monday through Friday in the daytime, and I could coon hunt any night I wanted to. So.
Well, that's awesome. I noticed on your Facebook page, there was a post there about a young man that just recently became a Georgia State Trooper. Is that right?
I'm not sure which one it is.
Okay. There was a post on there, and it was a younger man that was had just completed his training. I thought maybe it might've been somebody in your family.
Okay. That was probably my grandson. That's been a year and a half or something like that.
Okay. So your grandson's following in your footsteps then?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, when we talked for a few minutes the other day before we decided to, we're setting up the time to get together, and we've got, I had a battle trying to come up with technological issues, I guess I should say. But at any rate, you told me that you kind of had an accident out hunting the other night. Tell us about that and how that's coming along.
Oh, well, I stepped in a stump hole. I got a bad leg last year on January the 30th. I had a mule that had kicked a hole in the barn fighting with another mule and cut his back foot bad. And it wouldn't quit bleeding. Everywhere he stood, there'd be a puddle of blood. And, of course, it was a Saturday afternoon. And finally got a vet out here. And She said, well, we need to sedate him and where I can clean the wound up, sew it up, bandage it up. Everything went fine until it was time for him to wake up. And he would start to get up and get up too fast. And a couple of times he fell with his head bent back behind him. We skidded, break his neck. And my wife was squatting down by a bush hog mower over there. He got up again and started stumbling backwards and fell on her. And so the vet said, I got the mule. Go see about Teresa. And I ran over there to it. About the time I bent over her, the mule came flying back, stumbling again, and fell on both of us. And it broke my right leg and ankle and broke her left leg. And we both had to have surgery and couldn't put any weight on them for 3 months. And we got pins and plates in our legs now. And the other night when I was hunting, I stepped in a stump hole with that bad leg, and it was pretty sore the next day.
Well, I can imagine it was. I remember my first encounter with those stump holes was when I went to work for AKC, and they moved me to Raleigh, North Carolina, and a lot of piney woods there and all, and I discovered those stump holes. It's where the old stump's there, and they just kind of rotted out and left a hole. Isn't that about right?
Right, that's right. They usually camouflage with leaves. So it's kind of like a booby trap.
I gotcha. Well, you know, we're going to definitely talk a lot about coon hunting, about your dogs and all that, because this is primarily a coon hunting show. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit about you are, to use a common term, I guess, a son of the South. You grew up in Georgia, and I know that most of my friends across the South are very, very proud of their Southern roots and the great history of the South. And of course, we all know about the Civil War and how that turned out. But there's just so many great stories out of all that. And I learned that you have kind of taken an active role in keeping some of that history alive. What can you tell me about that, Hal?
Well, I've been a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans for over 20 years, and it's a great organization. We do a lot of cemetery work. In fact, there's a Confederate cemetery here in the town, the county seat, the county I live in, Barnesville. And the soldiers there were buried during the Atlanta campaign in the summer and fall of 1864. And a lot of them were unknown markers on the grave. Some of them were known. And over the time, it had gotten almost impossible to read them. And our ISCV camp has replaced all the stones with new stones. We moved the old stones. We didn't throw them away. We moved them down as footstones. And in the meantime, we got the medical records for the Confederate hospitals that were here in Barnesville and identified, I guess, probably 40 or 50 of the soldiers that were previously unknown. And they come from all the states in the Confederacy. There's one Union soldier buried there from Connecticut. And there were no prisons here. In 1864, they had a train wreck during the Battle of Atlanta close by the town here. And it was a train load of prisoners and wounded coming south. And hit head on with a train load of supplies going north. And so Wow. The only reason I can figure out that Connecticut guy's ended here, he must have been a prisoner on that southbound train.
I'll say, I look back in my own history. My dad was born in Middle Tennessee, and my grandfather, who I was named after, his name was Stephen, but his father's name was Nathan. And there is an article that appeared in a local paper there back in the day that my grandfather had written in, kind of like how we write in an op-ed piece or something. And he was a wheelwright. He made wagon wheels. He made them, from scratch, the hub and the spokes and then put the metal tire on them and all that. And he, too, had a long beard. Yeah, I have several pictures of my great-grandfather. But in this story that he wrote for the newspaper, he talked about at the end of the Civil War and how that when the Union soldiers kind of came through, they took all the horses all the stock that they had on the farms, which made it pretty difficult, you know, for them to make a living at that time. And I'm sure there's a lot of that history all throughout the South. You know, it was a terrible time for our nation, but it was also a very proud time, I think, for the people who lost, a somber and serious time for people who lost family members in that war.
Right.
For sure.
Yeah, sure was. There's a lot of stories about that, but they didn't carry off the killed as far as livestock
and
stuff. But
the spoils of war, I guess, you know.
Right.
Any way we look at it, war is a terrible thing, I know. Well, and you also posted something, and you and I were talking about this a little bit, and I don't know. You have mules, don't you?
I've got two mules.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You coon hunt off those mules?
No, I don't. It takes long enough to get your tracking collars and your dogs loaded and everything else. And I've never coon hunted on them. I just pleasure ride them.
I got you. I'm sitting here looking across the room at a drawing by the artist Joe Vick. I don't know if you've ever met Joe or seen any of his work. He comes around to all the major coon hunts, like Autumn Oaks or Grand American and so forth. And he uses a pencil and draw. He's really good. And a lot of his work centers on old barns and mules and that sort of thing. Well, my grandfather, Fielder, was legally blind. He couldn't drive an automobile. And he worked his farm there and raised 9 kids on about an 80-acre farm there in Tennessee with a team of mules, old Pat and Trim. And I'm looking here at them now because I had Joe to take a picture of my granddad. I mean, use a picture of my granddad and put him into a photo, a painting with the two mules and the barn in the background. And it's just one of my most treasured things because I remember very well my granddad, you know, hitching up the mules and working them, you know, when I was a kid. I was only 6 when he passed away. But granddad would harness those mules and drive them 8 miles to town on Saturday to do his business there and then drive back home. But I've always liked mules too. So you got a lot of things that are interesting me here.
Well, I've always been fond of mules myself.
I see. Well, in talking to Bill Scheninger, he mentioned, and I didn't put this in our notes, but I just happened to remember that he enjoyed awfully much the stories that you told him about your family. Is there anything that you could share with me there maybe that we didn't think about before?
Well, one thing is I'm living on the land that my family's lived on since 1821. And that's when they settled this part of Georgia and drew land lots in 18. So this is the 200th year that my kin folks have lived here.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I guess we don't move around much.
Well, when you know, there's an old saying that goes around, and I don't know if it's that popular in Georgia or not, but it is sure around the country. If you see something there's something that you really care a lot about, you say, I wouldn't take a farm in Georgia for that, you know?
Uh-huh.
You ever heard that expression?
I've never heard that one.
You didn't? Sure. Oh, man, that was up where I grew up and all. You know, it'd say, man, I wouldn't take a farm in Georgia for that dog.
Well, I guess in Georgia we already had the farm, so that's why.
I guess. That's for sure. That's for sure. Well, since this is a coon hunting podcast, or we do venture out and talk about other types of hunting with dogs and so forth, I wanted to talk to you about your experience coon hunting. When did you first get the bug? When, can you remember your first experiences?
I was probably 11 or 12 years old. My daddy was a coon hunter. He hunted black and tans, was about all he hunted. And I loved going with him. And in fact, one time I think I was probably 11 in the sixth grade or something like that. I got a bad report card, and I loved coon hunting so much that my punishment was I couldn't coon hunt till I brought my grades up. And about the time I was in my late teens, I wanted to get dogs of my own, and daddy about quit coon hunting. And so anyway, I was pretty much on my own then. And so basically I've been coon hunting for 50 something years.
I'll be darned. Well, what kind of dogs did you have back then? What did your dad have? Or
he had black and tans.
That's right, you said that.
Some of them are registered. One or two were grade dogs. I remember he had a Wagner bred female and a Bloodworth bred male.
Yeah.
My first good one, was a half blue tick, half black and tan.
I see.
I called him Moses. What happened was when I started coon hunting by myself, some of my buddies would go with me, and I had three or four dogs, and I hunted 1 year, and I think we treed two or three possums and a three-legged coon. My daddy gave me some advice, and I listened. He said, "What you need to do is pick out your best dog, and go see Cliff Jacobs about hunting with him." And Cliff Jacobs was an older black guy that my daddy had hunted with when he was hunting a lot. And Cliff was happy to have a young guy go with him and do the driving and help carry stuff. And then plus I had a few places to hunt, and he had a few places to hunt. And so that one first season that I hunted with Cliff, we made a coon dog out of Moses. And that was the first good dog I had.
You know, the first coon dog that I can remember my dad having is, my dad was a pipe fitter. I've told the stories that we mentioned in an episode here that aired recently with Trent Williams, the bluegrass musician there from Ohio. But anyway, his dad traveled around. He was out working in western Kentucky, and we lived in Charleston, Missouri, just across the Mississippi River there at the mouth of the Ohio. And he met a fellow there that was a barber and was a coon hunter. And he had made a cross, and this dog was, I believe, half black and tan, a quarter blue tick, and a quarter bird dog. And he got two of these pups, and he gave one to his brother there in Tennessee. And I remember my dad having Sam. Sam looked like a black and tan, a typical black and tan, but he had stocking feet, white stocking feet, and some white in his chest. And that was the first coon dog that I remember at home, you know, and Sam apparently had distemper when he was a puppy, because what the vet said, that he would go into these seizures at the tree when he'd get excited and tree barking. Sometimes he'd throw him into a seizure, and he eventually, I think, either died of that or maybe had to be put down. But there again is a parallel, you know, the grade dogs, most of people back in the day, you know, had grade dogs. Was it that way there in Georgia, mostly grade dogs? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was mostly grade dogs. You didn't see that many registered dogs at all back then.
Right. Yeah. Were there a lot of coon hunters in your area as you were growing up? And
there were several. There were a good many. There's a lot more than they are now.
Yeah.
My daddy used to hunt with Charles McCracken, and Charles kept dogs and I guess bought them and hunted them for Cass Walker.
Okay.
Charles didn't live very far from us. They hunted together a lot. And then Mr. Tom Rusk was a dairy farmer. He coon hunted, and there were several around.
Yeah, well, our listeners, the older ones like us, Al, remember Cass Walker and his ads in Full Cry magazine. And I have a lot of family in Tennessee. Cass operated those I think they were called Cost Cutter Supermarkets around Knoxville, Tennessee. But he was a coon hunter and quite a character, and he had a TV show that he'd be out coon hunting the night before, and he'd bring in two or three coons and throw them on the floor there in front of these, in front of the camera, and he'd talk about his hunts, and then he put those ads in. You remember his ads in Full Crime Magazine?
Oh yeah, it'd be about two pages, and a lot of them he called Ledbetter Courage, a guy from Mr. A.D. Ledbetter up there.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I enjoyed reading his ad.
Well, he did, and he seemed to have, and I don't know, I can't verify it, but he seemed to have a pretty solid guarantee on his dogs. If you didn't like it, bring it back. He'd give you another one of equal value. I don't know if he said he'd give you your money back or not, but he was quite the character. I mean, real colorful part of coon hunting history. And if you want to go on YouTube out there, listeners, and do a search for Cass, C-A-S, Walker, and there's one on there that's really funny. He's talking about people swiping women's purses on the parking lot out in front of his store. And he said, you all think that's pretty good. He said, but I tell you what we're going to do. If you do that anymore, we're going to catch you, and we're going to fix you right up. We're going to put you in the best hospital in town. Oh, he was a character. Well, that's funny. I hadn't thought about Cass, but you brought him up there, and that triggers so many memories. And back in the day, you know, the magazines were full of dogs for sale from various kennels. And Cass was one of those for sure. Well, what kind of a hunting territory do you have there where you hunt now?
Rolling hills. We don't have a lot of real tall, steep hills, but it's not flat land in this part of Georgia. We have rolling hills, some beaver swamps. You can go a few miles west of here, and the Flint River's down there. And we have a Well, in some parts of the country, they would call what we call Potato Creek a river. It's a pretty good-sized body of water, and I have one hunting spot that borders Potato Creek. But the best way to describe it is just rolling hills.
I got you. Is there still a lot of farming around there, or is it,
It's a good bit. A lot of beef cattle farming.
I see. Well, now, I know that a lot of guys get set on a certain breed of dog, and we've got these seven breeds now that UKC recognizes, and I think all our listeners know who they are. For many years, there were six, and then they added the American Leopard Hound. But you've kind of taken a little bit different tact with your dogs. You're not real particular about the breeds, are you?
No, I'm not. I've got leopards, I've got plots, and I've got plot cur crosses, and I've hunted all seven of the breeds recognized by UKC. The breed doesn't matter to me as much as how the dog handles and his ability. It to me is the most important thing. I'm not a big fan of paper. Some of my dogs are registered, but until I get ready to breed them, I might, lifetimes, I don't even permanently register.
I got you. Well, if you're not playing, of course, within UKC now and PKC, you can register them as crossbreds. Right. But if it's really not in your interest to start a line of dogs or keep a certain line of dogs going or enter competition, I can understand why that wouldn't be important to you. Now, do you do any competition hunting at all, or have you done it?
I have in the past, but the last cast I was on, this will give some people that's been around a while an idea how long ago it was. It was a 3-hour cast, and I was in a great dog cast. So it's been a while.
Well, that's for sure. I was at the UKC when we had all the talk about having 2-hour hunts as opposed to 3 hours. And I believe it was PKC that first started doing that. And there was quite a controversy, you know, back and forth, some wanting to stay with the three, some wanting to go to the two. Mostly it was the clubs that wanted to go to the 2 hour because it made it easier for them to get guides for the hunts. And right. And back then, the casts were judged, you know, by non-hunting judges, the champion casts were. So anyway, I remember John Wick saying that if a man loves the coon hunt, he'd rather have a 4 hour hunt, you know, than right. a 3 hour. I mean, why cut it short? But I can sure remember those days. They were 3 hours, of course, when I started competition hunting back there in West Virginia. Hunted mostly in Virginia and Ohio and West Virginia. And man, you could get out there and maybe tree a coon or two and have a pretty decent score. But it was something else to keep that score for 3 hours, you know.
I know. That was my problem. The Moses I hunted in that hunt, and I was being honest with it, you know. And Moses, one of his faults was late at night, he would open his mouth on some tracks that he should have just passed up.
Yeah.
And that was the problem.
Yeah, bite off a little more than he could chew there, man.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was a good honest cast. The two guys I was hunting with, one of them had a black tan female and grade dog. The other one had a grade Walker male, and he's a real good friend of mine. And we hunted together a lot. And of course, he was a grade Walker, and I was figuring a score in my head. And the guy with my buddy with the grade Walker was he had the scorecard. And I thought Moses had minus that, and my buddy told me, he said, Moses is minus fat. And I said, yeah, I thought he had. And he said, there's not any doubt in my mind which one's the best dog. He said, I've seen Moses tree a lot of coons by himself. He said, Sonny never has treated a coon by himself. The other guy chimed in and said, well, my dog ain't never treated a coon by herself either. But they got first and second place, and Moses minus that. And I said, well, this game just isn't for me, you know. And they yeah. were, nobody cheated or anything. It was all honest, but I just didn't like it too much.
Well, you know, you bring up another issue that a lot of the younger hunters for sure won't remember or won't know about. But there was a day back when you were hunting for night champion points that the dogs second and third and fourth place in a cast could get points depending on the size of the hunt. In right. other words, if there weren't enough cast winners with plus points, then he'd go down to second and third and fourth place in the cast. And that's kind of where some of the notorious hunters back years ago, when you hear about people cheating in the night hunts, there was a certain group at times would say at the beginning of the hunt, well, I need a first. What do you need? And well, I've already got my first place. It was required to have at least one first place toward night champion, and then 100 championship points. And somebody said, well, I already got my first. All I need's a second. And that's how they kind of got their heads together sometimes. And we get that old story of meeting in a coffee shop, you know, and filling out the scorecard. I'm not trying to give anybody any ideas, okay? But that sort of thing, you know, did happen at times. But the registries have done a good job of straightening out a lot of that. And I don't think that happens very much. And especially now, because if you don't win your cast, you don't have anything at all. And it's right. kind of been changed now to, you know, just beating the dogs you draw, that's all. You know, so I think it's a better system for sure.
Well, I don't play the game, but I felt like for years, it's not a very popular opinion, I feel like before a dog makes night champion, he should qualify on the HTX myself.
Yeah, you know, that's a good program, and I was glad to see UKC come along with that program. where the dog has to go out there and prove that he can run and tree coon to get that title. I know in the years that I was with the UKC registry, that was a very popular suggestion by people that before you give that dog a night champion title or degree, you need to take that dog out and have him prove that he can do it alone.
Right.
And, you know, they kind of did that with the single registration process that, you know, if where you could bring a dog in whose parents, you know, he hadn't been litter registered as a puppy. Maybe his pedigree was from, you know, crossbreeding or whatever. But you had to present a pedigree, a handwritten pedigree, and you had to go to an inspector and have that inspector see that dog running tree a coon by himself and then sign off on it. And I think that procedure is still in place. Through the breed associations. So it wasn't a bad idea, but it just wasn't feasible when you were having all these hundreds of night hunts all over the country and these dogs finishing out and then send them back and have them, you know, hunt to get certified. But it wasn't a bad idea for sure, Al.
Right.
Well, how many dogs do you have right now?
Well, all total, I think about 13. I got a couple that are retired and one that's probably getting close to being retired. And then I got a Stevens Kerr squirrel dog but the dogs I coon hunt, that's 10. I kind of rotate them. It depends on, some of it depends on how tired I am or where I'm going hunting as to what dogs I take. And, I got some that hunt closer than others and others that, I don't have a dog that's going to be a half a mile from me. But I got dogs that hunt a little deep for some of the places I have.
I see. Well, in noticing back what I mentioned at the first of the podcast about seeing your posts on social media, that you kind of mix it up, it seems like. You know, I'd see you there posting a photo of maybe two or three hunts in a row, and it'd be different dogs each time. So
yeah. That's the way I do it. Out of the 10 dogs that I'm talking about, 5 are leopards, 3 are plots, and 2 are plot cur crosses.
I got you. So do you try to kind of pair them up, a dog that's pretty strong with one that's in training, or do you, how do you make those decisions which ones you're going to take?
Well, that, a finished dog with a young dog is usually how I hunt them.
Right.
And I've got a young dog that hunts close, and I've got a couple of females that hunt close, and so I carry them together. That way your older dog's not running off and leaving the young dog, and, you know, he can participate and learn.
Well, that's, you know, I'm talking with a young man up in Virginia that has all kinds of territory to hunt. That's one thing about the podcast. I get a lot of people that contact me, and that's been really the greatest reward of doing these podcasts, is especially meeting these younger hunters that are starting out, or maybe they've coon hunted a little while, but they've got a lot of questions and they, you know, run up against problems from time to time. And I guess they think because I'm old, I know things, but I do love to, you know, interact with those people. And this young man, I was able to bring a puppy back from up in Pennsylvania for him. And he's got this pup now that's about 4 months old. He's wanting to get him started, but he doesn't have an old dog right now. And he's been looking around trying to find a dog that he can trust, you know, to start his pup with. And he was mentioning, he said, I rarely use a cage coon or anything like that to start my dogs, my pups, but I usually just take them to the woods with an old dog. But he said, you know, I don't have that. And that kind of brings, before I get into that, I want to ask you, now, do you have a favorite breed, though, although you've got these three breeds now, basically, or the crossbreeds?
It would, I like the plot dogs because of the history. Like we've talked about, I'm a history nut. I like the history of the plot dogs.
Right.
But I like the leopards I have. But really, a friend of mine asked me a while back, said, if you couldn't have but one dog out of all your dogs, which one would you keep? And I told him Pearl. And Pearl's half original mountain cur and half plot. And for my style of hunting, she just really suits me the best.
Okay. Well, let's talk about then. How do you typically hunt coons?
I walk hunt. Basically, if I'm taking some of those closer hunting dogs, I hunt like most people squirrel hunt with dogs. I just ease through the woods. You know, if I can find an old woods road that's easier walking, that's the way I go. And the dogs go out and either tree something or they check back in. I walk a little further. And then sometimes I got a couple of leopards that can get deeper than the rest of them. And I'll turn them loose and more or less follow them a little bit. And if they check back in, I'll send them another direction. But I walk hunt just about 90% of the time. In fact, my dogs aren't used to a truck driving around to them. So the ones I've trained aren't. You know, they used to be coming in on foot.
Well, that's keeping you in shape, I know.
It has to be.
Yeah. And that's a good thing, you know, and because I think we've all, you know, in our society today, we've all gotten lazy to a degree. You know, I remember when we didn't have four-wheel drive equipment when I was a kid in the mountains, and we'd drive out to a hollow somewhere and, you know, and park at the mouth of the hollow and turn the dogs loose. Well, we knew however long that hunt was going to be, if it was going to be the daylight, we were going to be walking all of it, you know. There weren't any roads to drive around. To get to the dogs or whatever. And of course, now I'm at the age, we're getting ready to go out to the White River in Arkansas, out to the refuge out there. And I'm mighty thankful that they've got these ATV trails everywhere out there. So we can, you know, my buddy Nubbin Moore, he's 80 now and I'm 75. So we kind of appreciate the fact that we can cover more ground, you know, but we still have to park the ATV. They don't let you just drive them through the woods. Right. So, you know, if the dogs are in there 700-800 yards, that's usually about the longest walks we have to take out there. I know one night we walked 9 something, I think, to Nubbin's black dog, but that's about it. And, yeah, I know that's the way I grew up hunting, was just walk hunting. The way you described.
You see a lot more. I like it because you're out in the woods and you run up on different things, see a lot of different stuff, old steel sites and, you know, just old farm equipment that's been abandoned in the woods and just in pretty spots. Like there's one spot I've run up on a couple of times that I've been on top of a hill, and I bet it's 2 acres of just granite rock at the top of the hill.
Wow.
And it, you know, if you just run in and drive around to the dogs, you miss a lot of that, and that's what I enjoy.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. And you just bring up so many memories for me, Al, because that's the way it was hunting the mountains of West Virginia when I was a kid. My dad told me, he said, Steve, you know, one time these mountains were full of people. You know, there were settlers everywhere, and we'd come up on an old house place, and there may not be anything left there but the chimney, you know. He said, be careful, you know, around there might be a well or something here. And I remember one night the dogs treeing in an old house way back on a ridge, had no idea that there was a house there, and they got in there, and that coon, it was living up in the attic in the living room of that old house. And of course, when he come down out of that attic, there was a big fight in the living room floor of that old house. And I often thought that somebody came by there and looked at all that carnage there. They think there'd been a murder there or something, but, you know, another thing, you mentioned farm machinery. I remember one night in Michigan, my dogs had treed around this patch of woods. Well, a lot of patchwood hunting up there. where you've got row crops of corn or soybeans, some grape vineyards, things like that. But I'd walk those edges, you know, and my dogs had gone left and to the west and a good distance in there and were treating. And I was just huffing it to them, you know. And I don't know, something just told me, Steve, watch where you're going, because the weeds were up a waist high, you know. And about the time I stopped and looked down, there was an old hay rake there, right there. If I'd have got tangled up in that thing as hard as I was walking, it'd probably speared me in several locations.
Most likely.
Yeah, I guess. Well, you cracked me up the other day. You posted a picture, you mentioned something about your dogs maybe treeing some kind of what we'd call off game. I don't know if it was a possum or whatever. Maybe you just mentioned this to me. And you said if it climbs, it ain't trash. What's your philosophy on that?
That's my saying. If it climbs, it ain't trash. If it can go up a tree, my dogs aren't going to get any correction from me. I kind of, like, you know, you're talking about the old school hunting, but, you know, years ago in the Depression and all, people ate the possums and this, that, and the other, or sold the furs from bobcats and everything else. And if I'm just happy to hear a dog tree. Most of the time I tell my hunting buddy that goes with me, if we tree a possum, I said, well, we ain't skunked. You know, I had rather them tree a possum than not do anything.
I got you.
And especially not run a deer or a whole armadillo.
Well, you know, what we're touching on here is the pure love of a tree dog, you know.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of the younger guys, and I hate to keep talking about younger guys, because, man, God love them. I'm glad they're out there. I'm glad they're enjoying the sport. I've tried to do what I can to preserve this sport for the next generation and so forth. But I just think they kind of lose sight sometimes when the winning takes over of the fact that it's just a joy to be out at night with a good tree dog and hearing them, you know, find game and tree the game and go there and see it. And I know that's the way my dad and his brother started out, you know, there in Tennessee. I've got a picture taken, I think, in about 1937 of it's in my book, of my dad and his younger brother and two cur dogs. And they've got two coons stretched square, the way they used to stretch them years ago. And then there's a bunch of possums. And they're skunk hides too. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that's what they did. You know, they and of course, growing up in the Depression, my grandmother would tell the boys, you know, catch a young possum, bring it in here, and we'll, you know, pin it up and feed it for a while. And then there'd be possum and sweet potatoes on the dinner table, the supper table.
That's right. Yeah. That's the way I am. I just enjoy the being in the woods and having dogs tree something. And you can just think back, well, you know, if there weren't any grocery stores, if I was living back in the mountains and had to depend on these dogs for food, could they feed me? And, you know, if they tree possums, they could feed you.
Well, the way meat prices and everything are going now, you might be on to something there, you know. We might all have to take a page out of your playbook there.
Another thing about, you know, you were talking about younger people wanting to win and everything. And my wife told me something one time that made my hunting a lot more enjoyable. After I figured out she was right and I thought about it. I came in one night, dogs hadn't suited me for three or four nights, and I got progressively in a worse mood, you know. And she asked me, said, are you perfect? And I said, no, I'm not perfect. I said, you remind me of that pretty often. And she said, well, why do you expect your dogs to be perfect? And I got to thinking about it, and I said, you know, she's right. And when I quit expecting my dogs to be perfect at everything, it makes coon hunting a lot more enjoyable.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I got caught up a little bit with that in this cruise dog, this young walker dog that I've got. And I just got him back home yesterday. Man, it feels good to have a dog around here again. He'd been up there in northeast Georgia since back in January. But, you know, he's bred pretty well. I mean, he's got a lot of famous dogs in his pedigree. He started out young and all. But, you know, like any dog, he's had some faults. He's had been a little, he give up on a bad track a little too quick sometimes. And I get to thinking, you know, man, he needs to be more accurate and he needs to be this and he needs. And then, but just like what you're saying, you know, as I look back on my experience and down through the years, through life, whether it was in marriage or as a Christian or whatever, you know, I've had a lot of faults, a lot of mistakes. And I think that's great advice, Al, that we all could benefit by that for sure. Well,
I promise you, it makes hunting a lot more enjoyable. With dogs.
Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of your wife, does she hunt with you at all?
She used to, but she was a trooper too for a few years.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And back in 1992, when the Rodney King riots in California overflowed to Atlanta, she was sent up there on the riot squad, and she got hit with bricks and bottles and everything, rocks and everything else. And it crushed some nerves in her leg and permanently disabled her. And she can't go through the woods anymore.
Well, that speaks to the job that you do out there as a public servant. And God bless her. And, well, listen, we mentioned a little bit about, do you clean the game you tree? Do you ever eat tree game?
Yeah, I clean every coon I catch. As soon as I get home, I clean it. We eat it. I've got friends that eat it. And to me, if it's not something like a armadillo or a coyote that's bothering you, I'm talking to me personally. I don't really, you know, try to judge other people. But to me, it's a sin to kill something like that, a coon, a squirrel or something, and just throw it in a ditch.
Yeah,
I clean them all. And in fact, to me, squirrel's the best wild meat in the woods.
Oh, I agree.
My wife, she'll roast coons. She makes Brunswick stew, which I came to realize that a lot of people up north don't know what Brunswick stew is, but in the south, down in Georgia, we have it in every barbecue restaurant. But my wife will use coon and Brunswick stew.
And explain that, because, for instance, like when I go to Orangeburg for the Grand American, I go into Duke's Barbecue there. There's a couple of places there, and they have what they call hash. Now, is that the same thing as your, what well, you're calling?
I don't know what hash is.
Okay.
Her Brunswick stew usually has chicken in it, maybe pork, coon, squirrel, rabbit. The last batch she made had rattlesnake in it. And then, you know, you got some tomatoes in there and corn in there. And some people put like lima beans in there. And it's just like a stew, you know.
Well, it's kind of what we called back home or back up in Michigan when we'd have a wild game supper or something. We call it a hobo stew, where you just take a big pot and everybody bring vegetables, you know. Might be canned vegetables, might be fresh vegetables, but and just put it all in the pot with some meat for some seasoning, you know, and all. But that sounds good. I've eaten rattlesnake. I haven't eaten it in a stew, but I did do that. The first time I ate that was when I was in service out in Texas. But well, that's interesting, and you know that was kind of the way it was at my house. My dad, he'd say, if you're going to shoot something, you're going to dress it. We call it dressing it out. And, man, I'd come home from squirrel hunting some nights, and I knew I had homework to do and stuff, but I'd be outside cleaning those squirrels. And I didn't like it, but I knew they better be cleaned, and they better be in the refrigerator in a bowl or a pan in some salt water, you know.
Right. That's same way here.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Okay, well, let's talk about a little bit about your what kind of gear do you use for coon hunting? You've already told me you're a walk hunter. Do you wear frog leg type or wader type boots, or do you just wear leather?
I started, I can't remember if it was last year before last, wearing the frog leg type. They're yoders.
Okay.
And for years, I saw those. This is one mistake I made. Before that, I always wore like knee boots, rubber boots, and I always thought that these frog leg things would fill up with twigs and everything else and get all down around your feet. And I said, no, I don't want those things, you know. And I finally bought a pair, and I love them. I don't have trash in my feet like I thought I would. I haven't had wet feet since I started hunting them. I kept a boot dryer for years because it was gonna go over your knee boots.
Yeah.
But these are yoders and they're snake proof.
Yeah.
And waterproof and I don't have. I always wore like Dan's or Wick overalls when I hunted with the knee boots. But these, I wear overalls every day. And with these things, I just wear the overalls I had on that day.
Yeah, just pull them up and you're good to go, aren't you? John Wick, said years ago when he invented the frog leg type wader, he said, you know, when your feet gets wet, the fun's over. And, of course, he was selling boots, you know, but there's a lot of truth to that. And, well, you mentioned snake proof. Do you have a lot of snakes around where you are?
We have a few. I've never seen a poisonous snake when I'm hunting, but I've had one dog bit by, I guess, was a copperhead when I was hunting. But I've never seen one. There's no telling how many I walk by.
But, yeah, if you don't look for them, you don't find them. Usually.
That's right. But we have copperheads in some parts of in this area. Some places I hunt, we have rattlesnakes, but it's mostly copperheads. Right.
Well, what kind of light do you like?
I got a sunspot, and I like
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And I use a Garmin Alpha 100. Right. I tell you, that's the best thing they ever came up with. if I'm turning a coon loose, I have a live trap for a young dog, I put a Garmin on it then, because if it doesn't go right up the tree and the dog gets, I feel like a fool with my Garmin sitting at home and not on that dog, you know. So that's, every time I turn one loose, I have a Garmin collar on it. I carry my coons a little different. It's kind of an old school way. I've got a sack with a shoulder strap that you sling over your shoulders, and that's how I carry the coons out in that.
I see.
And the other old school equipment I use is I got a cow blowing horn.
Oh man.
Yeah. And I'll, every day when I feed my dog, I got one horn I keep in the dog food barrel. I blow the horn when I feed them. And then I try to get both my dog's tone broke, and I blow the horn and tone them and get them to come in. And one thing I like about the horn is if you and your dogs end up where you really aren't supposed to be and you want to get your dogs and get out, people, if you go hollering for your dog and calling it, they know what that is. But this day and time, people don't know what a cow horn is blowing.
Well, they don't. And it just so happens, if I can work it in, I don't know. Sometimes things happen for a reason, I guess. But I recorded a horn, because I've got one here right in the room where I'm sitting right now in a display case, is my dad's calling horn that he had for years and years. And that's the only way that we could get our dogs in, you know, and especially if one got out of pocket on us or whatever, or young dog ran a deer and over the ridge and got away. But so hopefully we can include that in this podcast. Okay, I want to ask you about the horn. When you blow a horn, do you get a deep sound of it out of it, or do you get a high pitch kind of a squeal-like sound out of it?
Mine's more of a deep sound.
Yeah, and that's the way the one that I grew up hunting with, the one I mentioned that's on the wall. I have another one here that was given to me, and I believe it was by a hunter in Texas, and it has my name carved in it. And I blow that thing and all I can get is a high-pitched squeal out of it. You know? And that's kind of the way the fox hunters back in West Virginia, they like to squeal that horn, you know, that make their... Well, we'll have to have a podcast about calling horns sometime and
I'll tell you a funny story about that happened. I think it was Jim Poole asked for that blowing horn. At that time, we had a jack donkey in the barnyard, and I was hunting behind the house and was calling in a dog, and my wife could hear that horn. I was pretty good way. I was a long ways back there. She could hear that blowing horn, and then the donkey would start answering it.
So she knew what you were up to then, and yeah. She probably wasn't too happy with you. All right. Well, let me ask you this: how long will you typically hunt in a night's hunt?
Probably average about 2 hours, especially now with this leg that's not 100%.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I hunt almost every night if the weather's permitting. I it's not unusual for me to go 8, 10. Well, one time I know 115 nights in a row, but usually about 2 hours.
Well, do you prefer to hunt by yourself, or do you usually take somebody with you, or does it matter?
Both, really, and for two different reasons. The guys that hunt with me don't have coon dogs, and honestly, that's the way I like it, because I've always got a young dog.
Yeah.
And, you know, you put two young dogs together, it's like two teenage boys.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I enjoy them going with me. I'll go to some maybe bigger woods or tougher places when they go. Mm-hmm. But two, I enjoy going by myself. And the reason for that is most of the time when I go by myself, I'm taking a younger, you know, well-started dog and taking him by himself. Mm-hmm.
And soloing him out, yeah.
Right. And you really hate for somebody to drive down to go hunting with you and you not take the, you know, a... You not take one of your better dogs and try to tree some game for them. So if I'm hunting by myself, that's when my young dogs get to work by themselves.
Right. Well, and here's a subject that might be a little touchy to some, but, you know, I grew up with the plot breed, and people used to think, well, a plot dog's ill-natured, you know, they're bear dogs or hog dogs, and therefore they're mean dogs, which, and you're telling me you like a plot, you have some cur dogs, you have some plot cur crosses and all. Do you ever have any issues with young dogs or so forth and wanting to be aggressive?
Over about the only problems I have is dead coons.
Okay.
When a coon's dead and they get their mouth on him, the best thing you can do is put him in the sack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they get to claiming it at that point. Right. Don't they? Right. They get jealous. So,
and you got dogs that, you know, won't growl with another dog bouncing off of them at the tree, or won't growl in a box. You won't have, but they will get into it over a dead coon. A lot of them will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some stories that I remember. We had a pair of plot dogs, Sam and Hoss, and they were big 55-60 pound dogs, muscular. Those dogs would ride back in the day when I was young. I talked with Lee Kearns in South Carolina the other day, and he's going to be on a podcast that will have aired before this one. So, but anyway, we talked about hauling the dogs in the trunk of the car, and that's kind of the way we did it back then. Because, well, for one thing, we couldn't afford a truck and a car too. And right. Mother wasn't going to settle just for a truck. She wanted a car to ride to church in on Sunday morning and to go shopping and whatever. My dad was always accommodating, you know. So anyway, we'd haul those dogs to the woods. They'd hunt together all night, tree together all night, shoot coons out to them. They'd be fine. Put them in the trunk of the car on the way home and go around one of those steep curves in West Virginia and sling one of them over into the other, and it'd sound like you had a bucking horse under the lid of that car, and we'd have to quickly pull over and get them apart and get them settled down, you know.
Since you mentioned that, let me tell you about my dad's hunting vehicle before he got a truck. It was a 61 Ford Falcon station wagon. And I looked in the full cry. I was just a kid. I found in the full cry. I remember the name of the place I ordered it from. It was Art Craft. And it was bigger than a basketball, a circle thing. It was yellow, like a full moon, and a coon's face in the middle of it. And I'm sure my mama made, since I bought it with my own dollar and a half and ordered, I'm sure my mama made my dad put it on the back of that station wagon on the back glass. But that's where it ended up. And we drove back and forth to school in that thing. But anyway, all he had was some Lumber Fours with chicken wire on them behind the back seat, tied up with nylon cord to keep the dogs at the back. And there's two stories about that thing. One is him and Albert Taylor was younger than him and a little bit older than me. They went hunting one night, not too far from here. And within 10 minutes, those two black and tans killed two skunks. And they had to ride back in that 61 Falcon. And Albert told Eddie, said, Wilson, all right, you said, I'll just ride back on the hood. And he said, no, you ain't. They both rode back home with their heads hanging out the window. And the other thing is that to lift the tailgate down on that thing, you had to roll the back window down and reach in, and there was a lever you pull sideways on it to lift the tailgate down. And that Raider, that big old Bloodsworth dog, the first thing he would do when you load him up was pee on that handle. And so every time you went to unload the dogs, you got a handful of dog pee.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, that was what we hunted out of station wagons. That was the precursor to the trucks, you know, and when I was a kid. And we had kind of like what you're saying. We had a crate made out of 2x2s or something, I don't know, and chicken wire. Was the first one, you know, and it just slid in there. And of course, it kept the dogs contained, but it didn't do anything about the odor, you know.
No.
and you know, those dogs coming back home when they were wet and they stunk and they get the passing wind in there, and you'd have to roll the windows down and your eyes would be watering. Oh, they call them the good old days, Al. Well, listen, let's talk a little bit about how you start your pups. Do you start out with a pup usually, or do you like to buy a started dog or whatever?
I usually start out with pups, and I'm a little slower about trying to start them than most folks. I like for a puppy to be at least 9 months old before I try to show him any game at all. Now, I walk him through the woods and try to get him used to, you know, crossing creeks and coming when you call him and stuff like that. And I have about an acre fenced in. It's a training pen. It's made for squirrel dogs. I got squirrel feeders in there. Of course, the squirrels can come and go. But I'll put a young dog in there with an older dog. Usually a dog that I don't hunt. I call a pen dog. And they live in there for, you know, and until that puppy gets treeing good. And sometimes I'll turn live coons loose for them. I hardly ever trap a coon myself. People bring them and give them to me. And I'll turn them loose for them. And sometimes in the training pen, sometimes, you know, of course, if I turn one loose in the training pen, when he comes out of the tree, you can get out. But sometimes outside, back behind the house.
About what age do you put the puppies in that training pen?
9 to 10 months old.
Oh, okay. So you let them grow up, in other words, pretty much.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the way I do it. I've had better luck with starting them if you get a little age on them.
Yeah, well, I think that's wise. And I get this question. I mentioned the young fellow there in Virginia and several other guys. Like, they'll have puppies 3 and 4 months old, and they're laying drags for them, and they're doing this and that, and it's in the dog's not barking up and he's not doing, hey, he's a baby, you
he's
know.
He's a baby. That's what I tell folks.
Yep, exactly. Let him grow up. Everything's new to him anyway. They're easily distracted at that age because all those smells that are out there, you know, are new. I've long subscribed to that. When I was a kid, you know, we didn't really expect a dog to be doing much till he's 2 years old.
Right.
You know,
right.
Of course, I don't say that you wait that long, and the way dogs are bred nowadays, I don't think you have to. But do you think among your breeds that you've been associated with, do you think any of the breeds seem to start earlier than the other?
Really and truly, of my dogs, not in my experience. I hadn't done it in a while, but I did put some dogs for the public, young dogs for the public in my training pen to get them started on squirrels. And one breed of dog that I noticed just about all of them started quick and easy and young were those Parnell Carolina Curs. Are you familiar with those?
I've seen them listed in the magazines and so forth, but no, I'm not familiar with them.
They're Stevens Kerr and Feist mixed is what they are. I've never owned one, but I've started several in the training pen, and they seem to catch on quick and young.
Well, I had a good experience out in Texas when I was in the Air Force hunting with a Stevens Stock Kerr dog, a little female named Susie. She belonged to elderly gentleman named Ray Colson out there, and she was a for real coon dog. She could cold trail, she was fast on track, good little tree dog. That's my only real, and I've got a high school friend, actually he's older than me, and was a policeman in our town, Bob Wood, up in North Carolina, and he's got Stevens Stock dogs. But beyond that one experience in Texas, I've never really been around them that much.
Well, I haven't either. I've got a Stevens dog now, and I've had one or two in the past, but this cross with the curves in it, I mean with the feist in it, I don't even know the percentages they try to get. They were early starting dogs in my experience.
I got you. Well, do you when you have trash problems or things like that, do you use an e-collar at all, or do you?
Yes. I don't armadillos and deer are the two things here, but over the years, I really and truly don't think dogs are as bad about running deer as they used to be.
I don't
know whether it's the bloodlines or whether, and especially where I live, there's so many more deer. They get used to them. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, that's one of the problems, but things about this young Walker dog that I've got. I've never had deer problems with him. I did suspect him a time or two, bump a deer maybe a little bit his first year before he's a year old. I know he'd open on something. He wouldn't go, he'd cover a little distance and then he'd be back. And I figured he might be bumping deer a little bit, but when I was a kid growing up, and then when the Walker dogs started coming into our country, the registered dogs, it was expected that they were going to run deer, especially the young dogs,
And no tracking collars and no shot collars.
No.
All you could do is for days is ride around and look for them,
How well I know that. That's the most frustrating thing in the world, of trying to find a lost dog where you really, all you know is where you turned him loose or maybe where you last heard him. Beyond that, you don't have a clue where he could be. And I don't want to put that all off on the Walker dogs. We had plot dogs that would run those deer, too, that had to be broken, it's young dogs. John Wick came along with a breaking method, and I'm not going to go into it in detail, and you probably heard of it and seen it, but that worked real good on the plot dogs that we had that seemed to want to run a deer, but they like to catch stuff. And so they'd kind of break themselves off of those deer because if they weren't catching it, they weren't, too much interested in it.
Right.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you have a couple of retired dogs, another one that maybe is on the verge of retirement. About what age do you just go by the individual, or do you kind of have a cutoff there that you don't take them anymore?
By the individual, really. I know one of them that's retired as a Busher Stock female, Mountain Cur, and she cut her foot real bad several years ago. She's 14 now. And the bit about had to reconstruct one of her front feet. And then I noticed a couple of years ago, when I'd carry her, she could she wanted to go and she'd go out and hunt, and then when she was heading back, she couldn't hardly make it, limping and all. And it was just time to retire. And then others, sometimes they'll get the tree and slick on you, and it's about time to
Well, we do foolish things, you know. The older we get, that's for sure. Do you have a favorite dog, Al, that you can look back on? You mentioned old Moses. Yeah. Is there one that kind of stands out over the years?
Well, I was crazy about Moses and a lot of others I had, but the one that stands out was a dog. He was a registered mountain cur named Potato Creek Zeke. And he was a Kimmer bred cur. I got him from Robert Kimmer when he was 5 months old. And that's before they had the Kimmer Breeders Association. They were all mountain curs back then.
Yeah.
And I remember I went up there and he had two of those dogs, had two litter mate males at 10. And he told me, said, before you pick out one, said, I'm going to have to check with Roy, my son, because he wants one. And so anyway, went back to the house and he asked Roy, he said, this man's going to buy one of those pups up there. I said, which one do you want? And Roy said, well, I let him decide for me. In other words, what I didn't take, he'd take. So we went out there and Robert turned the two pups out, and one of them came up to us, you know, all friendly and wagged his tail, and the other one put his nose to the ground and went down through a little head of wood down there. And I said, well, I want that one going yonder. he was the most honest dog I believe I've ever hunted.
Meaning accurate, right?
Yes, sir. When he treed, you could about load the gun. And he was a direct son. The people, the cur dog folks are know about it, but others won't. But he was a direct son of Kimmer's Yellow Jack. And he was probably my favorite of all time.
I see. Yeah. Well, that's great to look back on those that you really really like and appreciate. You know, you mentioned that term about honest. Back in the day, we hear today about dog slick treeing, and they'll say he's a slick treeing idiot. You know, well, back in the day, we'd call them a lying coon dog is what they were. Well, okay, we already talked about you like to walk hunt. I had the question there about which way you like to hunt. We have been at this now about almost an hour and 20 minutes.
Was it that long?
Man, I tell you, when you get together with somebody that's a brother in the sport and enjoys the same things, the time just seems to fly. But what about the sport of coon hunting? What are the major changes that you've seen in it through the years?
Loss of land.
Yeah.
I've said for years that the animal rights people wasn't going to stop the coon hunting. It was going to be the real estate agents.
Yeah.
And really and truly, that's why a lot of my dogs people wouldn't have, because they're closer hunting dogs. But I can put them in places you can't put a go yonder dog in and still have a good time.
Good point.
And it's going to get to the point, unless you're hunting WMAs, a national forest, or something like that, people are going to have closer hunting dogs if they're going to continue to hunt. Yeah. I know some people that have quit because, you know, they just don't want to make the switch. And, you know, and they have to drive 40 miles to WMA or national forest to hunt. And, it, you know, after a while, they just quit. And if you don't change to a closer hunting, better handling dog, it's a nightmare.
Well, for sure, and we addressed this here the other day in a conversation about these go yonder deep and lonely. They've picked up this term now, ambush dogs, that just try to go until they find a hot coon they can get under. And handlers like that because they can score that coon, you know.
Right.
They know it's there. But absolutely. It's going to have to come back around full circle.
Right.
And, of course, the way you hunt, Al, is the way I learned to hunt. And it was probably more out of necessity than anything else, because I had to walk in rough. I was in rough terrain, which your terrain maybe is not as rough as what I had.
No, but it's not.
Coon were scarce, you know, and you just couldn't have dogs that blew out the country on you, because you'd lose them and your hunt's over. Right. You know, they might go over the mountain and tree something, but you'd never know where they were. So, you know, having gone through that, of course, then I got into the competition scene and was very much a part of it through my registry work all those years, and went out with a lot of good hounds, you know, in these hunts and all. But I see that it's going to have to come back full circle if we're going to continue to do it.
Right.
Here in Florida, when I was here in the 60s, it was nothing but ranches in Central Florida. It was ranches and orange groves. Now it's condos, apartment buildings, shopping malls, subdivisions. You know, everywhere you look, they say 900 people a day come into Florida, move here. So, but we're going to do it as long as we can, aren't we?
That's the truth. And equipment has, you know, you got your training collars, your tracking collars, the lights, all that's a big improvement from what it used to be, your four-wheel drive truck. So there's a lot of positive things, but it's just, it's the only negative is really the lack of large chunks of land.
Well, that's true. And it's universal. Anywhere you go, pretty much you're going to hear the same thing as people talk about the threat to our sport. Is there a story that comes to mind, a favorite story, something that happened to you out there in the woods, or a night that just kind of stands out in your mind that you want to share?
Well, I got a funny one, but it involves possums, really.
Hey, if it climbs, it ain't trash, right?
There was an older guy that used to hunt with me some named Melvin Clark, and he always said the best things out of the woods are possums and squirrels. And I had that Zeke dog, the camera dog, and a little gray, black and tan looking cur dog, and she loved to tree possums. And my experience with possums, we always got them and fed them out and then killed them. And so if she treed a possum in a sapling or something I could get to, I'd climb up there or shake him out, or, you know, get the possum. And then you had to move a live possum somewhere to put him in the truck and carry him to Melvin. Well, this went on several times, and one night he was hunting with me. And I had those two dogs, Gypsy and Zeke, and they were running a coon. They went into a swampy place and treed. And when we got in there, they were split. They had evidently run this coon in there on top of a possum. And Zeke was treeing up a tree that had the coon in it. And about 20 yards away, Gypsy was treeing up a tree with a possum in it. So we shot the coon out. And the possum was up. He was on the first limb, but it was a pretty good sized tree. And we got the coon out, and Melvin said, "I sure would like to have that possum. I sure would like to have that possum." And I knew he couldn't climb the tree. And I said, "Melvin, I can't climb that tree." And he said, "Well, just shoot them out. Shoot them out." So they taste better out of the woods anyway. So I shot him out. And so after that, I would bring Melvin brick possums dead out of the woods. And, and one time I took that same little Gypsy dog, little black tan cur dog, squirrel hunting. She was a pretty good squirrel dog. And as soon as, I'll never forget, it was a Sunday afternoon in February. And as soon as we got out there, she pulled this possum out of a stump pole and killed it. And I knew where I was. I hung him up in a sapling. We went on and killed, I don't know, two or three squirrels. And on the way back, I carried him by Melvin's. And so anyway, the next day, I went by Melvin's, and it was one of those raw February days. The wind was blowing about 30 miles an hour, and it was cold. And Melvin said, "I just cleaned them squirrels, and I'm fishing to clean that possum." Well, they'd been dead almost 24 hours. he was going to scald and scrape the possum like you do a hog, and you know, leave the skin on, get the hair off. Well, I guess it was so cold and windy, it had made his hands, the temperature wasn't right on the water. His hands were cold from dipping them in the water. He was trying to scrape the hair off the possum, and it wasn't working. And he said, "I know what I'll do, come in the house." So I followed him in the house, and he went to his bedroom with a wood-burning heater and took the eye off of it and put some little sticks and kindling in there and got him a fire going and stood right there in his bedroom and burned all the hair off that possum. He was sounding him in and out of the heater. And you know how burnt hair
is. Oh, my goodness.
And the house... house was filling up with burnt possum hair smoke. I had about all I could take. I started towards the door, and he said, "Open the door, open the door." And I opened the front door, and he went and opened the back door, and had a big draft coming through the house, and he stood right there and burnt all the hair off the possum. And anyway, when he got through, its belly was swollen up, and it was black, charred looking. And there was a guy that had he was a insurance agent here in Barnesville, and about once a year he liked to cook different stuff. He liked calling himself a chef, and about once a year he'd get Melvin to bring him a possum. Well, that's the possum Melvin cook over there, and he cooked that possum, and they drank some whiskey and everything, and I guarantee you the guy thought that the possum had probably been shut up, you know, a couple of weeks, but the dog killed it when she brought it out of a stump hole. It laid around for a whole day, and then he burnt the hair off of it.
And for more tips like that, consult Al Metcalf culinary page on Facebook. That's a great story, Al. My goodness. Hey, my friend, this has been just an awesome time. I have enjoyed this so much, and we're definitely going to have to do this again. But the next time I record with you, I want it to be sitting on the tailgate listening to those dogs tree.
Okay, well, I've enjoyed it too. I can talk dogs all day long. I didn't know we'd been on an hour and 20 minutes.
Well, hey, you can't get too much of a good thing, you know. Yeah. It's been great, and we'll definitely get together again, and I'm going to try to get up there to hunt with you. I'd invite you down here, but I know you got much better hunting up that way than we do here in Florida. But I have a little saying at the end of every podcast as we close it out, and this time I want to say, if somebody asks, "Where's Fielder?" tell them he's gone to the dogs with Al Metcalf.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel, because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as 3 suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.